This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
You have been seeing the news about that Louisiana law that was struck down by the Supreme Court, a law that would have required abortionists to have hospital admitting privileges. What you may not know, because it simply has not been covered extensively by the media, is that the primary sponsor of that law in Louisiana is a pro-life female Democrat. She's pro-life because she is a Christian, and the governor that signed that law into law also is a pro-life Democrat who signed it into law because he is a Christian and pro-life. Why is that not in most of the stories? How does the media miss that? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So why wouldn't major media discuss State Senator Katrina Jackson and Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards?
Well, there's two levels to my answer to that question. Number one is neither of them is named Donald Trump, and neither of them is a white evangelical. And if your whole point in covering a Supreme Court decision about abortion is how it will affect this coming fall's elections, which means how will it affect Donald Trump, which means how will it affect white evangelicals, then you're not interested in Katrina Jackson or Governor John Bel Edwards. You're just not. They don't fit the story that you're telling about American politics. And by the way, Katrina Jackson is a Baptist, and John Bel Edwards is a Roman Catholic. So you've got a kind of an interesting mix there, but you have someone from the historic black church speaking out on an issue and then having her legislation eventually signed into law in Louisiana by a popularly elected statewide governor who is a progressive Democrat on many issues, but is in fact a pro-life Democrat. So my first answer to that is the story doesn't fit the template of what's going on this issue, which is supposed to be all about white evangelicals, and it's supposed to be all about how this will affect Donald Trump. Now, I'm perfectly willing to say that this may affect Donald Trump with white evangelical voters. I'm not saying that that's an irrelevant point. In fact, I would be willing to say that that's inevitable. That's going to be a larger point. What I did in my post at Get Religion was ask the question, can't we at least mention who created this bill and who signed it and how they are reacting to a Supreme Court decision that struck down their bill? I mean, aren't they somewhat relevant to the story? Now, the second layer to that answer, typical Mattingly long answer here, I apologize. The second half of that answer is that the press doesn't think this fits the template for the story. But at the same time, it goes without saying that this doesn't fit what Democrats need to talk about either. And at that point, we have to do something that we've done many times here in these podcasts. We have to do a flashback, the Wayback Machine from Rocky and Bullwinkle, and the way I like to describe it at Get Religion. We need to flashback to the summer of 2007. When that great scholar of demographics and polling, John C. Green of Akron, spoke at the Washington Journalism Center that I was leading back then. He was speaking to a circle of international journalists, about a third of which were from Africa, and they were very interested in a young rising politician who had declared that he was going to seek the presidency, but nobody was taking him very seriously at that time, and that, of course, was Barack Obama. Well, John Green put up on the wall, we had a write-on wall, he did this huge chart of what would become much more famous in 2012 as the study that talked about the religiously unaffiliated, the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And we talked a lot that day about the rise of the religiously unaffiliated, but toward the end, he made a political observation. And John C. Green is a political progressive, a Democrat, but is faultlessly candid about numbers. And what he pointed out, he said, in the near future, the Democrats are going to have an interesting problem. The largest religious niche in their party is going to be a part of the population that within a decade or two is going to be up to 20 to 25% of the American population. And that is this coalition of nuns, N-O-N-E-S, the religiously unaffiliated, atheists, agnostics, and kind of the surviving members of the hardcore religious left. And he said, what's going to be interesting about that is if that's who the Democratic Party is going to have to please with whatever they do on religious liberty, whatever they do on abortion, whatever they do on sexuality issues, at the same time, the most crucial ballot force, voting force, election day force in the Democratic Party remains African American voters. And if you know anything at all about the black church, you know that it tends to be heavily Democratic, but still it tends to be pretty conservative on moral and social issues. He said, so in the future, how are the Democrats going to be able to handle keeping the black church happy and on board while simultaneously not ticking off this new coalition of atheists, agnostics, religious left, and nuns? And I would say that to some degree, that's what we're dealing with in this current story. Katrina Jackson and John Bel Edwards are much older school Democrats when you look at the history of the party. When you look at the South, when you look at working class blacks, when you look at working class Roman Catholics, they fit the Democratic Party and its coalitions from the past. Katrina Jackson and John Bel Edwards don't fit the Democratic Party of right now. And thus, the press isn't that interested in them. I mean, you wouldn't want to complicate things for the Democratic Party if the Democratic Party is in the middle of ending the reign of Donald Trump. I mean, that would be, you'd be cutting against history. So on two levels, both of them political, these two people just don't fit. Why bring them up, even though they're the creators of the bill at the heart of the Supreme Court case? Now, does that make sense?
I want you to explain your headline for Get Religion. I'll just read, I assume you write your own headlines. This one rather clever on this story. Conservative News, : white GOP justice strikes down bill by black female pro-life Democrat. Explain that one to me.
I was pretty proud of that one, I have to admit. I've gone back and tweaked it to make my point more clear. After Conservative News, I put a question mark. My point is, if you wanted to find out about John Bel Edwards and Katrina Jackson, both Democrats, you had to read coverage of this case in conservative and religious news sources. That's the only people who thought these people were relevant. I mean, when you have to go to Baptist Press, a denominational news service, to find out the Democratic Party angle of this Supreme Court case, that's pretty strange. And if you want to find a feature story that goes in depth into the motivations of Katrina Jackson and why she does what she does and why she has been a consistent speaker at the annual March for Life and who she is, you had to look that up in the weekly newspaper of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Nolens. I just thought that was sort of funny. Then the other half of the equation, which is, I mean, this is one of the reasons why people are so interested in the responses of white evangelicals. Was it the Babylon Bee that said something like, Justice Roberts has formally changed his name to Anthony Kennedy?
That was me, actually.
Oh, congratulations. I had forgotten that connection. Honestly, I'd forgotten. But that's the other half of the equation. In other words, Republicans have picked how many of the last 15 or so justices? Do you remember the number? Isn't it like 12 out of 16 or something like that? But if the whole point of white evangelicals and others voting for Republicans is supposed to be to help shape the content of the court, those are pretty distressing numbers from the viewpoint of religious and cultural conservatives. So you could see why many of them might be upset at this point and like, well, if we elect Trump again, are we sure that we're going to get somebody that will stand for a conservative approach to law? The long-range trend doesn't look very good.
You talked about Baptist press coverage and you had to go there to find the story. What do you think about the secular media's coverage, USA Today, the Associated Press, Washington Post?
The actual coverage of this original story at the Supreme Court?
Yes, of the Katrina story. Katrina
Jackson.
Yeah,
it was. She's not there. With a possible exception of the Washington Post, included a pretty powerful quote from Governor Edwards, in which he talks about being a pro-life Catholic, and that motivating, his actions in this case and why he was so concerned about this. I think these were perfectly normal stories. And in this case, I don't see that as a compliment at all. They played them right by the books. This was about Trump. This was about conservative voters, and that means white evangelical Catholics, because we all know that that's the most important people. Now, if you're actually thinking about the election, like I said, the election is a valid news angle. Dick Osling, the great patriarch of religion writing who writes for Get Religion, Osling keeps making the point, in addition to this obsession with white evangelicals, nobody seems to have noticed who the actual voters were who put Donald Trump in the White House, and that was Catholics, primarily across the Rust Belt, up through the middle of America, where you expect Catholics and labor voters to vote for Democrats. But in this case, the percentage of Catholic voting for Trump was, I believe, something like 55, something like that. And why the press continues to be so obsessed with white evangelicals, when it is true that it's important that white evangelicals are losing some of their positive feelings about Trump, and many of them didn't have a whole lot of positive feelings about him in the first place. But I think you get the idea that probably not a lot of evangelicals are going to switch to Joe Biden. And I think that pendulum will swing back again, because who are these voters going to vote for? Well, like me, they could vote third party. I'm a committed member of a third party in the United States now. But once again, why not cover the Catholic angle of this story instead of just focusing on the white evangelicals? There are some Catholics in America who are concerned about abortion. I mean, that sounds like I was going for a funny laugh line at this point, but it seems to me sometimes that the press has a tendency to forget that.
In the private school funding case, why not mention that the court in this case was basically defending equal access principles that were established during the Clinton White House era?
Well, once again, that doesn't fit the template. In some ways, it's a direct parallel to the first one. If the whole idea is now the court on a 5-4 vote has given a victory to Donald Trump and to religious conservatives, and that means white evangelicals. Now, a lot of newspapers did notice that this case is linked to the infamous Blaine Amendments long ago, which set out to basically strike down the ability of the state to have anything whatsoever to do with private schools. And back then, that meant Roman Catholics. So the Catholic angle did get into most of the coverage of this Montana case. And that's good. It would have been really wild to have missed it, although it's pretty wild to miss including the creators of the bill from the previous case, as I said. Now, what struck me as interesting about this time is reading the New York Times coverage of the case over and over, there are several references to the fact that the justices kept saying, anything you do to help a secular private school, you need to also offer that same option to religious schools, because otherwise it would be unfair. Now, that sounds exactly like the equal access principles that were articulated so well back in the Clinton-Gore years when we still had a broad liberal and conservative church-state coalition that was trying to do some things that would be more tolerant. And the whole idea there, think back, you're probably used to hearing it in this context. If a public school is going to allow its facilities to be used by secular nonprofits, they need to be willing to rent the school to religious nonprofits like churches as well. Or if a school is going to allow students with proper oversight by faculty, if you're going to allow a chess club or an environmental club to meet after hours in school, you have to offer the same options to religious organizations. This is called equal access, and one of the key terms here is viewpoint discrimination. The state can't say that religious ideas are somehow uniquely dangerous in comparison to ideas that are espoused by secular nonprofits. Now, there used to be a tremendous amount of agreement on that during the Clinton-Gore years, and that's when the equal access laws kind of hit headlines and you got some coverage. Well, why not mention that this case now seems to be applying some of the principles of the equal access era to this subject linked to the Blaine amendments, which is, now, a state can deny aid, tax exemptions, etc., to all private schools, but it can't pass something that goes to secular private schools, but not to religious. You have to treat the two the same. Well, like with the first story, why not mention that, since that's an incredibly relevant concept if you read what the justices said? I would argue that, once again, it doesn't fit the template. Why bring up the fact that this used to be something that liberals and conservatives agreed on in terms of church-state concepts in the Clinton White House era, not exactly a high point for the religious right? Why bring that up if the whole point of the story is Trump, 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 white evangelicals, oh, yes, and also some Catholics in this case? If you've got the story preformed in your mind, why do you need to bring up any factual information that complicates the story?
Not to mention, it's a prime opportunity to explain what has changed and what has stayed the same since that era of cooperation.
Well, I mean, except then you'd have to talk about the fact that what blew up that coalition of liberals and conservatives in that era. I used to joke where you had everybody from the Unitarian Universalist to Pat Robertson sending in briefs on the same side of some of these issues. Didn't that just complicate the left-right, America divided 50-50, compromise is possible, tolerance is possible, old-fashioned liberalism is possible? once again, why complicate the picture, even if it seems to be exactly what the court did in this case? Maybe I'm just too old, you know, and I remember these things, and with my background in church-state studies, maybe I'm preforming the story in my mind to include these other details that I know, in fact, existed. And maybe in the era of Trump, there's just no need to deal with any of those facts and complicating themes if the whole world revolves around Donald Trump. And I guess that's not my world, but it clearly is the world that is shaping the coverage of these kinds of Supreme Court cases.
In that vein, with about 2 minutes here, Terry, I want you to address my growing exasperation with trying to consume news from mainstream sources and feeling like I have to go to quote-unquote alternative sources to get these angles, sometimes to even get both sides of a story, when I really shouldn't have to do that. I should be able to pick up something like the New York Times and get at least both sides of the story, about a minute and a half.
Well, no, I'm sorry. You're in the wrong era. Right now, with advertising-based journalism fading as the big tech companies lock up all the digital advertising dollars, what matters right now is whether the story and the coverage you're offering pleases your choir of subscribers and viewers and gets them to click things and forward them and gets them to pay subscriptions. Subscriptions are a huge part of what allows newspapers to keep open right now. And the problem there is, to some degree, you have to think about pleasing the people who are writing those checks. This is very similar, Todd, to what's gone on at the New York Times in the last couple of weeks with the battles inside that newsroom, where you had kind of an old guard who thought, well, maybe we should at least put up a pretense, an appearance of neutrality on some of these issues, and hundreds of people in the newsroom digitally shouting them down. I'm afraid that at this point, on subjects of politics, especially if it has anything to do with morality, culture, and religion, and Donald Trump, I'm afraid you're just going to have to do careful reading. And if people want to go back and listen to my Issues, Etc. presentation from almost 2 years ago, I listed a couple of suggestions on how to do that, and I'm afraid our churches are going to have to take that seriously and get involved in helping people be complex news consumers.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a production of Get Religion, part of the First Amendment Projects at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. If you appreciate this podcast, please make a secure, online, tax-deductible donation at getreligion.org.